This week's sermon is from the series Trusting God in Life's Muck, a sermon series on the life of Joseph.
We're going to start today with question, how do we feel when the underdog wins? And we know the familiar story of David and Goliath, and we know with God's help, David was able to overcome, but he was ridiculed. He was seen as, how can you, of all people, take down this big guy who's talking so boisterously as if he is the person who's going to overcome us all? And we're familiar with other stories. If anybody remembers back in the 80s when the movie Hoosiers came out, and we see that final scene, Jimmy making that final throw and winning the championship. And the thrill, the all that went into it before. One of my favorite stories is I'm a quiet Huskies fan, having grown up near Seattle. And in 1978, New Year's Rose Bowl, the Huskies were pitted against number 4 rated Michigan Wolverines. And I remember listening to that game. My wife and I were returning from, we were living in Mississippi at the time, and returning from Michigan, where my wife is from, having spent Christmas with my in-laws. And so while listening to the game on New Year's Day, traveling back home to Mississippi, it was a thrill to hear my home team beat Michigan, even though my wife's from Michigan and she's not a big Wolverines fan. But nonetheless, it was a thrill, because at the beginning of that football season, the Huskies were not expected to go anywhere. And yet, as the season progressed, we know, and it climaxed in that great Rose Bowl game, in my opinion, maybe not for, because Bo Schlenbecker was sure he was going to win the game. And yet the underdog prevailed. Now we come to a story where the forgotten prisoner, and it's, underdog of underdogs, here he is in prison, even though he's probably in an elite prison. Yet we see in this story, he becomes ruler of Egypt. A phenomenal change within hours. And so we've come to this story. We're here at Crossway, we go through sections of the Bible and proclaim and seek to instruct ourselves on what God is saying in different events in the biblical narrative. And we've been going through the story of Joseph. And so we can turn in our Bibles to Genesis 41, where we're at. And it's a long chapter. It's probably the longest chapter in this whole story. I was telling Brad, I said, you decided to take the week off and leave me with the longest chapter. So bear with me. We will probably go through this fairly quickly, but we'll get to the point. And to me, it is a beautiful story of where it is greater than the David and Goliath story, greater than anything Jimmy did at the end of that great game in the Hoosiers movie, as well as any other underdog stories that we hear. I'm going to read the first 16 verses, and then I'll read other sections as we go along. When 2 full years had passed, Pharaoh had a dream. He was standing by the Nile when out of the river there came up 7 cows, sleek and fat, and they grazed among the reeds. After them, 7 other cows, ugly and gaunt, came up out of the Nile and stood beside those on the riverbank. And the cows that were ugly and gaunt ate up the 7 sleek, fat cows. Then Pharaoh woke up. He fell asleep again and had a second dream. 7 heads of grain, healthy and good, were growing on a single stalk. After them, 7 other heads of grain sprouted, thin and scorched by the east wind. The thin heads of grain swallowed up the seven healthy full heads. Then Pharaoh woke up. It had been a dream. In the morning, his mind was troubled. So he sent for all the magicians and wise men of Egypt. Pharaoh told them his dreams, but no one could interpret them for him. Then the chief cupbearer said to Pharaoh, "Today I am reminded of my shortcomings. Pharaoh was once angry with his servants, and he imprisoned me and the chief baker in the house of the captain of the guard. Each of us had a dream the same night, and each dream had a meaning of its own." Now a young Hebrew was there with us, a servant of the captain of the guard. We told him our dreams, and he interpreted them for us, giving each man the interpretation of his dream. And things turned out exactly as he had interpreted them to us. I was restored to my position, and the other man was impaled. So Pharaoh sent for Joseph, and he was quickly brought from the dungeon. When he had shaved and changed his clothes, he came before Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I had a dream, and no one can interpret it. But I have heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it." "I cannot do it," Joseph replied to Pharaoh, "but God will give Pharaoh the answer he desires." And we'll read more as we go along. Pharaoh is faced with an unsolvable dilemma. Pharaoh, most recognized ruler of probably that time, for Egypt, was a nation that was indeed seen as the world power of the day. There were other nations, the Hittites, other nations to the east as well, but Egypt had that central importance, and partly because of the Nile River and its ability to help Egypt become essentially the breadbasket of the world. And here Pharaoh, as he's having these two dreams, finds himself in a deep dilemma. Now let's understand the setting at this point. The setting is Joseph's journey. Joseph, who was captured by his brothers, you know, he was sent by his father to check on his brothers, and his brothers said, "No, we're done with him. We need to get rid of him." They were tired of his being favored and all that, and so he's captured and sold into slavery by his brothers. Then he's accused falsely. You know, he gets sold in Egypt, and he's Potiphar's servant, but Potiphar's wife, you know, falsely accuses him of attempting to rape her, and Potiphar throws him in prison. And then the story goes, as we heard last week, is that at the end of chapter 40, the cupbearer, however, did not remember Joseph. He forgot him. And he's left in prison, as we see in the opening words of this chapter, for another 2 years. But what we need to remember through all this is that God does not forget Joseph. We learned in previous chapters here a phrase, "The Lord was with Joseph." The Lord was with Joseph. And one of the ways that God is with Joseph is he sends two dreams to Pharaoh, which leaves Pharaoh deeply disturbed. At just the right time, You see, what we need to understand about life as we experience it here in this world is that sometimes we think our timing is better than God's timing. And so we're often tempted to take matters into our own hands. It's the same instruction that, you know, Solomon gives in the Proverbs. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding, but we're often tempted to lean on our own understanding rather than simply trust the Lord. So at just the right time, God remembers Joseph in giving Pharaoh two dreams. And we know these two dreams. Seven fat cows come out of the river. Seven fat ears. There's great, you know, crop of whatever the grains are. We don't have a specific reference, whether it's wheat or, you know, we know it's not corn because corn was something that wasn't really learned, was something came from the Americas. But nonetheless, there were fat ears which showed that the Nile was doing its job. Nile River, one of the things that why Egypt could be so so productive in its, you know, cattle and crops is because the Nile was doing its job. It would flood the lowlands every year and leave the lowlands with this rich silt, helping you know, produce, you know, good crops. And as a result, you could have you know, you could feed your cattle and so on. So this the fact that Pharaoh is standing on the edge of the Nile and in his dream and seeing this, you know, happen had profound significance to Joseph. And these dreams are so profound that they're remembered in detail. Now, I know I dreamt last night. Don't ask me what the specific dreams. I can give you some vagary, but I don't remember the details. But these dreams are so profound to Pharaoh that he remembers them in detail. We see that in the coming verses. And he's quite sure they have special meaning. And he has no answer. And he's bewildered. He needs to know what they mean. So what does he do? He calls, you know, on his wise people, his magicians, his special advisors, the ones who are supposed to know. You know, those that are skilled in secrets and wizardry and magic, but also, you know, they were seen as the brightest and best. These were, you might say, the intellectuals of the day. And so in Pharaoh's estimation, these are the ones he needs to call, and they obviously should know. But none of them are able to tell him what the dreams mean, which leaves Pharaoh even further disturbed. See, what we need to understand here is that while no mention of God is made, we know that from, you know, seeing that the Lord was with Joseph, we know God is deeply involved in this story. This is no, you know, separate story. The focus has been on Joseph previously, and now we're brought to focus on Pharaoh himself. But what we need to understand here is that the power center of the world, the power leader, is rendered helpless. He's rendered helpless. He's finding himself in a place he doesn't have answers for, which leaves him bewildered, disturbed, perplexed. And what God is seeking to show here is to Pharaoh and to all involved, who's really in charge. That's the lesson here in this whole chapter. Even though nothing is said about God being with Joseph these 2 years, But God is more evidently with Joseph than ever before. So what does God do? He provides a solution to Pharaoh's dilemma. The forgotten Joseph, you know, he's in prison these 2 years, forgotten, and he's now remembered. The cupbearer's memory is jogged, but this is all in God's timing. We need to understand that. God's in charge here. So he tells Pharaoh what happened to him and the baker that he was imprisoned with when Pharaoh was angry with both of them. And the cupbearer suggests that maybe we need to call this Hebrew and have him come and interpret, because he interpreted our dreams with the same skill, because what this Hebrew had said came true. And so what is Pharaoh's response? He urgently calls for Pharaoh to come to the royal court. Pharaoh takes immediate action. Pharaoh wastes no time here. The text says that Joseph was quickly brought from the dungeon. The implication is that when Joseph gave orders for Joseph to be sent, no time was to be wasted, because Pharaoh is so perplexed, he needs an answer, and he needs it now. So to conform to Egyptian custom, for someone to come into the royal court, Joseph had to shave, he had to change clothes, he had to get cleaned up, of course. And Pharaoh is hopefully seeking an answer. But Joseph comes with his own surprise. You look at the verse here. What does Joseph say to Pharaoh? I can't do it. Can you imagine what Pharaoh must feel at that very moment? He had heard how Joseph had interpreted the dreams for his cupbearer and how they'd come true, and he couldn't find the answer amongst his trusted advisors. And Joseph comes along, you know, that he's hoping, you know. And Joseph said, I can't do it. Only God can. Because Joseph wants to make clear here is that God is in the center of all this. God is the only one who is able to make clear. God was the one who made clear to me what the dreams of the baker and the cupbearer were about. And we see this repeatedly, you know, different times to Joseph, to Pharaoh. Because what Joseph is saying, he says to Pharaoh, you're looking at the wrong person. We need to look at someone who is a whole lot better. And this is a very key theme that Joseph learned throughout his entire ordeals. God is involved in all of this. And so Joseph declares that it is only God who is able to give Pharaoh a favorable answer, that this is what will bring peace to Pharaoh. So what does Pharaoh then do in response? He retells what he experienced. In my dream, I was standing on the bank of the Nile, when out of the river came up 7 cows, fleet and fat and sleek, and they grazed among the reeds. After them, 7 other cows came up scrawny and very ugly and lean. Because one of the things you'll notice in the retelling of this story is sometimes some other details, you know, come to light from the first rendition. And the lean cows, he says, I'd never seen such ugly cows in all the land of Egypt. They were bad looking. The lean, ugly cows ate up the seven fat cows that came up first. But even after they ate them, no one could tell they had done so. They looked just as ugly as before. Then I woke up. In my dream, I saw seven heads of grain, full and good, growing on a single stalk. After them, seven other heads sprouted, withered and thin and scorched by the east wind. The thin heads of grain swallowed up the seven good heads. I told this to the magicians, but none of them could explain it to me. Then Joseph interprets what God has revealed to Joseph, to Pharaoh, about the future. Joseph said to Pharaoh, "The dreams of Pharaoh are one and the same. And God has revealed to Pharaoh what he's about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good heads of grain are 7 years. It is one and the same dream. The seven lean, ugly cows that came up afterward are 7 years, and so are the seven worthless heads of grain scorched by the east wind. They are 7 years of famine. It is just as I said to Pharaoh. God has shown to Pharaoh what he is about to do. 7 years of great abundance are coming throughout the land of Egypt, but 7 years of famine will follow them. Then all the abundance of Egypt will be forgotten, and the famine will ravage the land. The abundance in the land will not be remembered, because the famine that follows it will be so severe. The reason the dreams are given to Pharaoh in two forms is that the matter has been firmly decided by God, and God will do it soon." The important clue here is the dreams are essentially one and the same. They have a single meaning. They all point to one central point. Because when we get caught up in the details of what, you know, the specifics are about, we can lose what is being emphasized. Because the central emphasis is the certainty of God in all this. Note what Joseph says to Pharaoh in verse 25. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he is about to do. And then repeats that again in verse 28. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. And then finally in verse 32, the matter has been firmly decided by God, and God will do it soon. Egypt was an agricultural economy. And that's why these dreams had such impact upon Pharaoh, because Pharaoh knew that if something happened in the economy of Egypt, the future was going to be awful for him. It would be devastating. That's why he was so troubled. And when Joseph here is talking, he's talking about how there's going to be great abundance, but there's also going to be huge collapse. A famine so severe, never heard of before. One of the things you have to understand about it says about the east wind is if you know your geography from the Middle East, you know that east of Egypt is the Arabian Desert. And we know that when winds come off of dry areas, you know, hot winds, they have a devastating effect. And we saw that even this summer, how the impact they had even on things here in western part of the state and the fires that ensued. So Joseph makes his case and soundly sounds the alarm. He You know, Joseph could easily be seen as a fearmonger here. Fear is a powerful tool that can be used to motivate people with devastating consequences. But Joseph is seeking to come with hope versus fear. Even when he stresses in verse 32 that this is set by God, this is decided by God. God is at work here. And that's why we need to understand here in this passage that the sovereign God is at work here to save the world from famine. The sovereignty of God is the underlying theme in this chapter. And God wants to say to Pharaoh is that even the economy of Egypt, even in fact Egypt's whole future, was subject to God. And it is God to whom they must listen. And that's something we always need to understand, even in the present day, is God controls the destinies of empires in accord with his plan for his people. Because that's another dynamic that's involved here, is God is seeking to care for his people, to preserve his people. If there's a devastating famine that could starve a family to death, and we read in subsequent chapters that Jacob needed to send his sons down to get food so they could live. And we know that one of Jacob's sons was Judah, from whom Jesus came. So in this story, Pharaoh is to see that it is God who is controlling Egypt's life source, not the Nile River, not Egyptian gods, not Egyptian magicians. We know they tried, you know, if we remember the time of the 10 plagues when Moses was coming before Pharaoh, and it was some of the initial plagues, or even when Moses dropped his staff and it turned into a snake and so forth, the Egyptian magicians could somehow replicate some of those dynamics. So Pharaoh didn't always believe Moses at first. But one thing this Pharaoh is needing to understand is that it is God who is in control here. And so if we were to look at a theme of this chapter, we can narrow it down to this, is that the sovereign God exalts the prisoner Joseph to be ruler of Egypt in order to save the world from famine. Also meaning to save his own family back in Palestine. So what is called for here? The dream revelations call for bold, decisive action. Joseph continues, "And now let Pharaoh look for a discerning and wise man and put him in charge of the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh appoint commissioners over the land to take a fifth of the harvest of Egypt during the 7 years of abundance. They should collect all the food of these good years that are coming and store up the grain under the authority of Pharaoh to be kept in the cities for food. This food should be held in reserve for the country to be used during the 7 years of famine that will come upon Egypt so that the country may not be ruined by the famine." The plan seemed good to Pharaoh and to all his officials. So Pharaoh asked them, "Can we find anyone like this man, one in whom is the Spirit of God?" Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has made all this known to you, there is no one so discerning and wise as you. You shall be in charge of my palace, and all my people are to submit to your orders. Only with respect to the throne will I be greater than you." So Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I hereby put you in charge of the whole land of Egypt." Then Pharaoh took his signet ring from his finger and put it on Joseph's finger. He dressed him in robes of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. He had him ride in a chariot as his second in command, and people shouted before him, "Make way." Thus he put him in charge of the whole land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I am Pharaoh, but without your word, no one will lift hand or foot in all of Egypt." Pharaoh gave Joseph the name Zaphnath-Paneah and gave him Asenath, daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, to be his wife. And Joseph went throughout the land of Egypt. So Joseph, without hesitation, if you notice here in the reading of this chapter, you know, he's interpreted the dreams of Pharaoh. But before Pharaoh can really make a response, Joseph, without hesitation, says, "We need to do something. God's at work here," and proposes a plan for the impending future. Not only does Joseph say what God will do, but also what Pharaoh needs to do to ease the nation through this coming crisis. Because it's still 7 years away when the famine is going to take place. But nonetheless, Pharaoh had become so impressed with the significance of the dreams, even from the get-go, that he's listening. He's not interrupting, saying, "Joseph, I've heard enough. I got the dreams interpreted. That's fine. You say God is involved here," but no, Pharaoh listens. That's how troubled Pharaoh had become. This is a man who was at the height of the empire and was brought low in his soul to realize that something greater was going on than just ruling an empire. And so Pharaoh advises, you know, Pharaoh to appoint a qualified person who could be given broad authority over the whole of Egypt. And what Joseph is proposing is a 20% tax. Now think about that. If someone were to come to the leaders of our country and propose a 20% tax on all your income, all your resources, in our present anti-tax sentiments, we would yell tyranny to the top. But Pharaoh's listening. And he knows that he needs someone who is discerning and wise. He knows he needs someone who is capable of carrying out important economic measures to save the nation. He realizes that the future of Egypt is at stake. And if this counsel is ignored, Egypt will perish. Pharaoh realizes that. But what is Pharaoh's response? He's at peace. He knows he has the answer. He is pleased with Joseph's proposal. He looks around to his close advisors, and he knows immediately what he needs to do. This Hebrew may have just come out of prison, but we know he's the man for the hour. If you look closely at what Joseph is doing here in this experience, Joseph never suggested that he should be the one to fill that position. All he's saying is, "Pharaoh, you need someone who is capable to run the affairs of your country so that we can survive the 7 years of famine so severe that people forget how good things were." But Pharaoh is seeing something more is going on than just a man standing in front of him interpreting his dreams. Notice what Pharaoh says. Can we find anyone like this man? And note this phrase, one in whom is the Spirit of God. This doesn't necessarily mean that Pharaoh is now recognizing there's the God of heaven and earth, as we understand the God of heaven and earth. No, he's understanding that there is something more transcendent, greater than even the gods that Pharaoh had been accustomed to worshiping. There was something about Joseph that Pharaoh saw, that it was more than just a man, but in this man was the Spirit of God, of someone greater than anything Egypt seeking to promote. So, what does Pharaoh do? He makes essentially a proclamation, proclaims Joseph to royal command over all of Egypt. Now, this must have been a bit of a shock to Joseph. Remember what he'd been through. And then forgotten and left in prison, even though he was blessed in prison. You know, the captain of the guard had put him as a servant of his to oversee things in prison. But Pharaoh is now making Joseph ruler of Egypt with full honors and authority, subject to Pharaoh alone. Not subject to his advisors. No, second in command, the scriptures say. And how does Pharaoh show that? He gives Pharaoh, or gives Joseph his signet ring, which is a symbol of honor and authority. He dresses Joseph in the finest linen clothes, you know, which signifies that Joseph is now part of the royal court. He puts a gold chain around his neck, which is a symbol in Egyptian culture of very high distinction. And then has Joseph brought out to the people and that as the chariot brings Joseph around and you have heralds going out in front of Joseph saying, make way, make way. Which essentially says, bow your knee, people. This is ruler of Egypt to whom you must pay obeisance. And not only that, Pharaoh gives Joseph a new name. We don't know exactly what the name Zaphnath-Paneah means, but one of the elements from understanding Egyptian language and so forth people have shown is that it's something about life. And so some have interpreted this name to mean something to the effect that God lives and sees. So Pharaoh gave Joseph a name, recognizing, again, there's something greater going on here than just what we are familiar with in our Egyptian culture. And then Pharaoh also goes further and gives Joseph a wife. And not just any wife. She is a wife from a high-ranking priestly family. And what we understand about Egyptian culture is that the pharaohs of Egypt chose wives out of this family. So, in other words, Joseph was given a wife of royal standing, which has some additional, significance, something in whom Pharaoh was placing a lot of confidence. The head of the most powerful nation of that day. We must note here, has no power at all, but sees a greater power at work. And so what do we see happening here as we come to the latter part of this chapter? Bear with me, it's a long chapter. Joseph assumes high office in Egypt with established authority. Joseph was 30 years old. Not very old, at least from my estimation. Except when I was growing up in the 60s, we thought anybody over 30 was bad news. I mean, that was, you know, the cry of the hippies of the 60s. But Joseph was 30 years old when he entered the service of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from Pharaoh's presence and traveled throughout Egypt. During the 7 years of abundance, the land produced plentifully. Joseph collected all the food produced in those 7 years of abundance in Egypt and stored it in the cities. In each city, he put the food grown in the fields surrounding it. Joseph stored up huge quantities of grain like the sand of the seas. It was so much that he stopped keeping records because it was beyond measure. Before the years of famine came, two sons were born to Joseph by Asenath, daughter of Potiphar, priest of On. Joseph named his firstborn Manasseh and said, "It is because God has made me forget all my trouble in all my father's household." The second son he named Ephraim and said, "It is because God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering." The 7 years of abundance in Egypt came to an end, and the 7 years of famine began, just as Joseph had said. There was famine in all the other lands, but in the whole land of Egypt there was food. When all Egypt began to feel the famine, the people cried to Pharaoh for food. Then Pharaoh told all the Egyptians, go to Joseph and do what he tells you." When the famine had spread over the whole country, Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold grain to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe throughout Egypt, and all the world came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph because the famine was severe everywhere. In verses 46 and so forth, we see that Joseph sets out to procure resources for a difficult future. One of the reasons, probably, you know, the 20% grain tax was not as burdensome is because it was 7 years of abundance. So people were experiencing greater crops than they had ever experienced before. But they had to be gathered. They had to be stored. This is what Joseph was appointed to do, along with commissioners, other assistants to help him in carrying that out, representatives who were in different parts of Egypt to help get that all happen. And the crop surplus, notice this, it was like sands of the sea. They were brought to collection points. At first it says, records were kept, how much grain was collected. But after a while, the grain piles got bigger and bigger that it was difficult to even keep records. And this was all reflective of the success of God's plan through Joseph and his effectiveness as a ruler. And then we see God going further in blessing Joseph with two sons to assure him further of God's favor. And I would just quickly go through their names. But Manasseh, coming, which has a root in Hebrew to Nasa, which means to forget. And Joseph is recognizing something here. I'm naming my son Manasseh because he's reminding me that God is making me forget all my troubles that I've experienced before. That all the grief that he endured at the hands of his brothers could now be forgotten. And Joseph could lay aside his unhappy childhood, recognizing that God is at work here, seeing that God's hand is in it all, including the grace to put his past suffering behind. And then names Ephraim is sort of a compliment. God has been so good to me. He has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering. So Joseph declares that God has blessed him richly in the very land where he had been made a slave and a prisoner. In other words, what Joseph is saying, not only has God made me forget my troubles, but in Ephraim he says, God hasn't forgotten me at all. And God will not forget us, especially in making us fruitful and those around us in the land of our suffering. So Joseph is clearly in charge of all Egypt. We see that in Joseph's response to, or Pharaoh's response to the people as they come to him. We need help. We're running out of food. And Pharaoh says, no, you go to Joseph. Go to Joseph. He'll take care of you. He's the one in charge. Joseph is truly, clearly in charge. No one may question him. We read that in different places, according to what Pharaoh had said earlier to his officials in verse 38. As well as to Joseph himself, since God has made this all known to you, we know there's no one else. We know this is saying, as well as in verse 44, I am Pharaoh, but without your word, notice this, without your word, no one will lift hand or foot in all of Egypt. That's power. So Joseph is validated even when other countries show up for relief. So rising from humbling circumstances, Joseph was exalted to rule Egypt through these perilous times, which basically says God's truly in charge. So what can we learn here? The same God is present today in all world affairs, even when it seems that the powers that be are more in charge than anything. Because one thing we have to understand here is that Joseph is foreshadowing Jesus. He's reminding us of Jesus, who being humbled. And we read, you know, in Philippians chapter 2, you know, where Paul is encouraging Philippians to have this mind in you, namely that of Jesus Christ, who did not count, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, something to hang on to for the advantage of status, but made himself nothing, taking on the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, becoming human and staying human. He humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross. In other words, God is making clear, even through Joseph, what God wants to do with all of us. That's one of the lessons we're learning here, is that God is the sovereign one. God is the one in charge. And that Jesus, who willingly, Joseph was forced into slavery, forced into this state of humility, but Jesus willingly chose to do this out of love for us all. Jesus did this not to change God's mind about us, but to change our minds about God and his tremendous love for us. That's the point of Jesus, to whom, you know, Joseph was simply foreshadowing in bringing salvation to Jacob's family, to save them from starvation. And then not only that, Jesus has made himself nothing to suffer and die, but then God exalts Jesus to the highest honor to rule over all. Therefore, it says in Philippians 2, therefore God exalted him to the highest place at the right hand of God, as we confessed earlier in the Apostles' Creed, and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow. Make way, says God, make way. As Jesus rules in heaven and on earth and under the earth. And notice this, when Paul makes this phrase in that passage, it is over everything. Even under the earth was a phrase that referred basically to, you know, in the Old Testament mind, to hell. and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. And then finally, what we learn from all this is that the sovereign God is encouraging us here to entrust ourselves to his providential care. The Heidelberg Catechism in question answer 28 makes this phrase, "For all creatures are so completely in God's hand that without his will they can neither move nor be moved." We need not fear the future, what it will bring. Ever. We need not fear. Sure, we will feel anxious in our being. We will find ourselves troubled. But we need not fear because God is in charge. Yes, we live in perilous, uncertain times. There's COVID going on and we're not sure when it will end. You know, civil unrest has taken place. Political division. But we always need to remember that God is the one in charge of the future of our nation, the future of our world, the future of our lives, and how it will turn out. It's not who is or will be in the White House. It is not who is or will be in Congress or on the Supreme Court bench or in Olympia or any state capitol. It is God who's in charge. God is the ruler of all, who exalted Jesus, to whom every knee will bow and every tongue confess that he is Lord. God is sovereign, even while others claim to have power. Even when it appears that certain leaders or certain political parties will inhibit the healing of our land. What will truly heal our land is when we who are called by God's name, we, the ones who God has called his own, humble themselves and pray and seek God instead of a savior leader. And finally, God is calling us to seek first his kingdom and his righteousness. As Jesus said in his Sermon on the Mount, "Seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well." Or as the writer the Hebrew says in chapter 12, "Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God." Let us pray.
You are listening to a sermon from Crossway Church in Battleground, Washington. You can learn more about our church online at crosswaychurchwa.com. We invite you to attend a worship service on Sundays at 10 a.m. at 311 North Parkway.